Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak up. Kōrerotia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
Kia ora koutou, ko speak up kōrerotia tēne, ko sale kaltana hou. Sleep is a vital biological necessity. Good sleep helps our cognitive functioning, our emotional well-being, and physical well-being, and has been shown to help with things like longevity. Conversely, a lack of sleep has been associated with an increased risk of various health and well-being challenges, including some chronic illnesses. Yet despite this evidence, and despite the fact we spend about one-third of our lives sleeping, which is an insane amount of time if we think about it like that, sleep is very often overlooked in health and well-being. And I think one thing that I find fascinating is that sleep is really not often included in discussions of human rights, although it is implicitly acknowledged in various international human rights instruments and bodies, such as the ICCPR, the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights. And it's also embedded in certain rights, such as the right to health and the right to rest. And I think it's also really important to mention that international human rights legislation also recognizes the right to freedom from torture and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, which includes forcibly denying access to sleep. And I know that there's been some really fascinating papers written recently about the use of this sort of tool in Gaza and how lack of sleep is affecting populations there. So with this background in mind, today we're going to be discussing the significance of sleep and sleep health and their impact on issues of social equity. This is a topic I don't think is very often covered in human rights, and it wasn't something I necessarily thought of until I had a session on sleep through work with Dee Muller, who's one of our guests today. And it really made me think about, actually, sleep is really fundamental to our well-being and, I guess, by extension, to our rights. So we've got three guests, including Dee. I'd love to hear from each of you. If you could please explain who you are, ko wai koe, how have you got to where you are today to be taking part in this panel? Dee, how about we start with you?
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Ingarangi, ko Tirana, Irana, me Tiamana te whakapaparanga mai, engari ko Waitakere te whenua tupu, kei te whanganui a Tara, ue noho ana, ko Dee Muller taku wingua a tēnā tātou katoa. So, hi everyone, I'm Dee. I identify as a Pākehā woman. My ancestors hark back to England and Scotland and Ireland and Germany. I grew up in West Auckland, but I call Wellington home now, where I've lived over the last two decades with my family. I'm a Pākehā researcher at the Sleep Wake Research Centre at Massey University, based in Wellington. I used to be an occupational therapist. I worked mainly in adult mental health, and then through a few twists and turns, ended up falling into a career in sleep research. Most of my research focuses on child and adolescent sleep health, and I have particular interest in inequities in sleep and social determinants of sleep health for our young people and what that means for their mental health and well-being. So that's pretty much me.
Thanks, Dee. And we've got two guests from the University of Queensland.
Yeah, hi. So I'm Jaz Chawla. I'm a paediatric respiratory and sleep specialist. So I'm a clinician at the Queensland Children's Hospital in Brisbane, and I'm also associate professor with the Child Health Research Centre at the University of Queensland. So my research all focuses around sleep and how sleep impacts on function and cognition and behaviour in children. And it particularly looks at sleep with complex disability and, again, sort of focuses on how important it is in children with high-risk conditions to have good sleep for good function. My other role is that I am the incoming president for the Australasian Sleep Association, so I'm well into the advocacy role for sleep across Australia and New Zealand as well. So that's me.
Could you maybe tell us a wee bit about the association?
Sure. So the Australasian Sleep Association is the peak body for sleep health professionals in both Australia and New Zealand. We have a New Zealand branch and an Australian kind of core branch. It has around just under 1,000 members currently, and it has a mixture of members. So there's clinicians working in adult and pediatric sleep medicine, researchers, psychologists, allied health, dental, you name it, we've got it in the society. It's very diverse. And the society's goal is really to ensure that health professionals receive their educational needs around sleep and help to promote sleep health. We work really closely with the Sleep Health Foundation that focuses on ensuring we promote sleep health for the public. So we sort of work complementary together. And we do a lot of advocacy work at government level to try and ensure that sleep is in the forefront of people's minds and recognised as a priority for Australian and New Zealand individuals. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we do.
Very cool. Thanks.
And hi, everyone. I'm Sally Staton. I'm Associate Professor of Child Development at the Queensland Brain Institute, the University of Queensland. I come to sleep from a very social perspective. My background is really in child development and with a particular focus on children from birth to five in early childhood education and care contexts. And for me, my entry to sleep came from concerns around children's rights in early childhood services and how we were meeting individual sleep needs in those settings, and how we could inform policy and practice from an evidence-based perspective to ensure that we were meeting the needs of all children, but also not infringing on other rights of children as they attend those sorts of settings.
And I think it's fascinating that of the three, yes, you all have a focus on children's sleep and children's sleep and rights, which wasn't necessarily intended, but that's just how it ended up. So very cool. As we get into our discussion today, I think just to set us off, why is sleep so important? And it's a big question and there'll be lots of different answers, but I think it's really important as we start off today.
Well, I could go first if you want and start from the kind of more medical perspective. I guess if you look at it from a really medical point of view, sleep is kind of really active. And I think that's one of the things that people forget is that we're actually really active during sleep. It's not a time when we're not doing anything. Our brains are restoring, our bodies are repairing, and there's a lot of things that go on during sleep that are really crucial for your day-to-day function. Simple things like, you know, ensuring good growth, ensuring good memory, ensuring that we can learn. They all come from processes that go on during your sleep. So I think if you look at it from that medical perspective, it's crucial. But I think if you go even more basic than that, I mean, you think about a day where you haven't had a decent night's sleep and you've only had a couple of hours of sleep or you've had broken sleep. Let's be honest, you feel awful. And I think that we all know that, you know, it affects your concentration, it affects how you feel, affects how what you want to eat, affects how you want to exercise. There's no part of what goes on for you that it doesn't affect. So I think, you know, even if you don't want to take the medical view, it's really obvious when you think about what you feel like when you don't sleep well.
I agree. And I think for young people, that whole, as again, I'm sure we've all experienced, if you haven't slept well, that difficulty with those social interactions and connections with others. And, you know, for children and particularly adolescents, that's so important, that kind of social connection and navigating those social challenges day to day. If you're experiencing poor sleep, it can really get in the way of those super meaningful aspects of a young person's life.
There's also, I think, a really important developmental aspect to it, and probably because of that's where I come from, which is sleep is a developmental phenomenon, something that changes across our entire lifespan, and it does in a very predictable way, but there's also individual variation to that. And so sleep not only impacts on our development, it is also driven by our development. So what's happening in our brain underpinning all of the areas of functioning that we're talking about is this process of development, and our sleep reflects that and changes throughout our lifespan in alignment with that.
I knew you were going to say that, Sal, which is why I left that for you. So, but it is a really important point. And I mean, it's something I, in my clinical practice day to day, really focus in on with families, particularly when you're dealing with families who have children who have developmental delay or intellectual disability. you know, often I see kids and families that come to me, my clinics, who are really not managing any sleep, or they're managing very little sleep, and their kids, you know, sort of 5 or 6. And there's this sort of social societal expectation that they will be in their own bed and that they'll sleep for themselves. And the parents come really distraught that this is not happening. And sometimes actually the light bulb moment for them is when I explain to them that sleep is developmental. And if you think about the fact that your child walked a bit later and actually didn't walk till they were 3 or 4, their sleep learning and their sleep development is also going to be at that stage rather than at the stage of a 5, 6-year-old. And sometimes I think just explaining that to a family really helps them to understand why their child isn't managing to do things that they're expecting them to do. So I think the developmental aspect of sleep is really crucial for us to be teaching people about and educating people on, because I think it's something that's often missed, even amongst specialists. I think, you know, people don't necessarily frame it that way.
I think, Jazz, even when you take it out of the clinical context, but just to normally developing children and young people, that framing can be really valuable for parents and caregivers and also clinicians as well, because we're very tolerant to the idea that, yes, a child is going to start talking at a different rate to another child, and yes, a child is going to start walking at a different time to another child. And for the most part, that's fine and normal, and we're not concerned about that. And yet when we come to sleep, we seem to get to these very specific expectations around sleep that can cause a lot of distress to parents, a lot of concern, a lot of behaviours that we're then trying to modify that may or may not be problematic. Now, of course, there's a place for identifying when they are problematic and also supporting families when that can be quite disruptive for them, but also understanding that there's just a normal range, and while in the same way we shouldn't be comparing our children to another child in terms of when they first start talking, generally speaking, sleep is the same. We shouldn't be comparing our child to another child, because we're all very, very different and our brains are built differently, and therefore that's going to come through in the way that we sleep.
Yeah. And I think from some of the research that we've done at the Sleep Late Research Centre here, some qualitative research has really shone the light on the fact that so many parents and caregivers feel really judged and can feel very easily like they've somehow failed in their caregiver role when their child isn't sleeping a certain way to meet the perceived, you know, perfect way of sleeping. And I think we've got to push back on that as well, because I think it's important to get out there the message that sleep is really important for our well-being. But I think inadvertently sometimes those messages can feel a little bit judgy and prescriptive for all of us, but also those of us who have children. We can feel like there's a right or wrong way of supporting sleep, children sleeping a certain way. So I think that message that it's not a one size fits all, that there are many ways of sleep working well within households too, because sleep doesn't exist in isolation. You know, like there's kind of those interconnections within family units, within the households that any of us are living in, and then those wider layers of kind of social and societal environments. And so it's complex and it's not one size fits all. And I think that's important to understand.
I think, you know, what you said, Dee, one of the things that I was thinking of when you said that was that the adolescents, that, you know, that's a group in whom I think this is really important, that we actually are a little bit more fluid with the way that we discuss sleep with them. Because I think you don't really achieve anything about if you're sort of saying you must do this, you must do this, you must do this, especially at that age where they're really starting to kind of insert their independence. They've got a lot of pressures on them. You know, there's pressure to do well at school. There's pressure to be involved in outside activities after school. There's social pressures with your friends and your peers and making sure you don't get left out. And being online gaming is one of those things that might be what they, you know, feel they need to do to fit in. And I think if we come in as the kind of voice going, but I've pulled it all about to sleep, you're not going to achieve anything. And I think it's a really important group, and you need them to really understand that sleep is something that is important for them, but also that there is a choice around it as well. You know, like they've got to make those choices, but for them to understand that compromising on their sleep might actually then be affecting their health, that message has got to come through in a really unique way for them to really understand it.
Hits really, Jazz, onto a really interesting thing about sleep, because on the one hand, we know it's really, really important, but we really aren't capable of forcing ourselves to sleep. It's just physically impossible. And in fact, the more that we try to do it, the more difficult it is. And so sleep isn't kind of like other behaviors where we can choose to eat healthier or unhealthier foods, or we can choose to exercise. When it comes to sleep, the things we can choose to do is to create the environments that we need and create the environments and the social context that we need in order to support sleep and make sleep occur. We can't actually physically decide to do it. And we can't do that for ourselves, let alone our children. And so I think it's a really challenging one for people in terms of health messaging, because on the one hand, we want people to understand it, as Dee said, but also we have to understand that actually what we're really doing is focusing on creating the conditions to allow sleep to occur, and at all different levels, whether that's the family level, whether that's the home environment, or just the broader social environment, or the other places where sleep happens outside the home. And they're big social things. When does our start time at work happen? Or for adolescents, when is school start times? They're not always aligned to sleep. And so whilst, you know, we tend to think about the individual needing to do lots of things to support their sleep, there's also a whole social world sitting around them that doesn't always necessarily think about sleep or factor that in. And I think that's why organisations such as the Australasian Sleep Association and the Sleep Health Foundation are really important, not just about promoting the idea of sleep and sleep health being a fundamental human right and important for people, but that we have to make social decisions about the way things are set up to allow people to meet those individual needs. So it's a very complex area.
I agree. And I think that certainly shines through in all of the research around sleep health inequities in various populations. And certainly here in Aotearoa, we now have, you know, over 20 years of research showing that right from kind of preschool age through to adulthood, there are really stark ethnic inequities in sleep health. And when you dive into that, socioeconomic deprivation is a consistent factor involved in those inequitable patterns of sleep health. We were lucky enough to analyse some data recently from the Youth 19 study, which was the latest in a series of surveys with adolescents. It was a really rich data set with a whole lot of information, including some sleep information. And it's pretty confronting and disturbing to realise that there are large chunks of our adolescent population who just don't have those same opportunities to sleep well. And that's nothing to do with their individual kind of behaviours. So we saw that for Māori and Pacifica, adolescents were really disproportionately impacted by short sleep and less than ideal, you know, like late bedtimes and early wake times on school days. And when we dived into the data, socioeconomic deprivation, housing deprivation, and kind of insecure housing, which resulted in people needing to kind of move all over the place from night to night for sleeping, experiences of discrimination, they all mapped to poorer sleep health when we looked at those data. And I think that speaks volumes, because when we look at the groups of people in our population, socioeconomic deprivation, housing deprivation, experiences of discrimination, they unequally impact Māori and Pacifica peoples. And, you know, it's all kind of interconnected. And so I think, again, great to highlight that we all need to prioritise and value our sleep, but it's easier for some of us than others because of that unequal distribution of advantage and disadvantage and power and privilege, really.
Absolutely.
So there's a governmental responsibility in there to actually be tackling those social inequities, because they play out in sleep as they do in all other aspects of health.
I completely agree with you, Dee. And I think, you know, that's similar with the First Nations communities within Australia as well. Exactly the same as what you've said there in terms of the sort of social factors that impact on ability to have opportunity for sleep. And I think the other group, I mean, obviously it's dear to my heart because of my research, but we've had the opportunity to recently talk to lots of families of children with, you know, complex disability conditions who also often represent a lower socioeconomic status just by the way, you know, their lives are complicated by this diagnosis in a child, not always, but often. And what's really interesting is that there's the government responsibility. I think there's also a health responsibility. I've heard numerous stories over the last little while through my research of families who say they've gone desperate for support for sleep to their general practitioner, and they've just been told, oh, well, that's part of the disability condition, you just got to get on with it, you know. And I hear that repeatedly, and I think that there's a message there from health very strong coming through that your child doesn't deserve the same as another child just because they have a disability. And, you know, I do a lot of work in the disability advocacy space as well. And I think that at the moment that's really topical here in Australia, where we're talking about equity and inclusion for disability, but sleep barely even comes into the conversation, you know. And I think it's really, really, it's really crucial that that message is coming across with this as well, you know. And something that I feel really strongly about is that health have a responsibility here as well to ensure that we aren't actually sending messages to families that, oh, well, that's just part of what you've got to deal with because you've got a child who's high needs. I don't believe that that's, and that's where I then think that as specialists, we have to get that education out there. We've got to get that awareness out there that this is actually debilitating. I mean, the stories from families of, you know, being scared to drive because they're going to crash cars because they're so tired. The whole family's awake. It's not just affecting the child. It's affecting the whole family. Their own health suffers. It's an economic problem as well, because we're creating more health issues in families as a whole. So I think, as you said, it's complicated. It's all intertwined. But I think there's lots of levels which go broader than the individual making change. It's got to be bigger than that.
I agree. And if we don't tackle those higher level systemic issues, and it's just so unfair. And it is a matter of social justice. You know, it takes away people's rights and true opportunities to have healthy sleep. And as you say, that complexity within families when there are more complex health issues going on. And part of that, I do wonder about and I know there's been research done in Australia, which has been fabulous, and a little bit done over here in Aotearoa, you know, acknowledging that there's not enough of sleep being included in training of health professionals in lots of different roles. You know, that's also another thing. It's like, well, if key people in a child's life who are there to support their health and complex needs, if they don't know about sleep, then it has that trickle-down effect, doesn't it? On top of there not being enough sleep peeps. I don't think, certainly in New Zealand, for example, in psychology, there's very few psychologists who specialise in cognitive behavioural therapy for insomnia, for example. So there can be that scenario where people are desperate to get some support and maybe go to their general practitioner, but a lot of GPs have 15 minutes for a chat and that's all they've got available to them. And very few options of where to send people to get the, you know, most helpful support.
Definitely. You mentioned some of the work that we've done recently, and as part of the GP Education Subcommittee in the Australasian Sleep Association did kind of explore at the medical program level in universities, you know, how much sleep teaching is being received and how much is in the curriculum about sleep. And the results were, you know, shocking, really. On average, there's about 4 hours of sleep in medical programs across Australia and New Zealand. I mean, and that's in their whole training. 4 hours for something that, as you said at the beginning, Sally, takes up a third of our lives. I mean, it seems kind of a bit ridiculous when you look at it like that. So I think there is, you know, there's a real issue with what we're actually doing in terms of education around sleep, and something that we are trying to make change at a bigger level through the ASA. I think we're very aware of that, and you know, it's all aspects. You know, there's the issue around how much we're teaching, there's the issue around how we're actually implementing change within workplaces for shift workers, for example. That there's so many areas in which sleep infiltrates into day to day, but yet it's still not given the attention that it actually needs. And I mean, you'll probably be aware of the parliamentary inquiry into sleep that was done in Australia 2019, and it took us until I think last year or the end of 23 to actually get a response from the government. There were 10 recommendations there about how to make sleep a health priority and the importance of sleep, and we didn't get anything back until just recently. And it was just a kind of, yes, this is important, but there was no suggestion of any support to try and actually help that happen. And, you know, for those types of campaigns to really be successful, you need to inject cash into that. You need to inject a sort of more national approach to that. And that's something that we continue to advocate for. But it's a real problem.
And I think when there's not that understanding that actually sleep is that vital pathway for all aspects of our waking functioning and health and well-being, you know, it's not a nice little added extra. It is essential.
See, I think that often gets lost in that people are thinking and reflecting what you've said about the social equity issues and the inequities we see in sleep. And often what we don't think about is sleep actually provides a really important mechanism for explaining why certain groups of the population may end up with poorer educational outcomes, poorer mental health, greater issues with their physical health. Because often just being in a lower socioeconomic group in and of itself on some level isn't the explanation. There has to be a mechanism to explain it. Some of that can be about the kind of access to resources or stresses that occur, but the actual mechanism of how that then affects other parts of your life, such as productivity, work participation, etc. Sleep is actually a really good explanation for that, but we don't always treat it or have it in the conversation when we're having or strategizing around policy or practices that we need to kind of address some of these big issues of social inequity.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I know certainly here in Aotearoa, you know, thinking that of that step back in relation to what makes sleep difficult and then what also then resulting in far less of an opportunity to be healthy mentally and physically is, you know, like we have a major housing crisis here. Child poverty is a significant issue that unfortunately is growing. And I think, you know, there's so many outcomes that can be mapped back to those two major issues. But, you know, it stands to reason that it's going to be a lot more difficult to sleep well, you know, when you're struggling with insecure or really low quality housing, when there's not enough money to get food on the table. And again, through no fault of individuals or families, it's just a really tough gig when you're sitting in that position within a society where you are, you know, very unjustly impacted by really significant societal issues that we've got at the moment. Yeah, and I think if we can kind of show, as you say, that sleep really is that mechanism through which that plays out in a whole lot of poorer outcomes, and we really do need action at multiple levels, but we don't kind of get to the root cause, then, you know, I think nothing's going to change from that kind of population level.
I think it raises some real challenges too in terms of then how do we support families, children, individuals around sleep, because there are those big social issues and we want to address those. And, you know, there's lots of people trying to work on those in a range of different ways, although I think this is often missed in that conversation. But there is also that very salient, immediate need for children, families, individuals to be supported around sleep. And I think historically, and I mean, jump in, Dan, Jazz, but I think historically we really have focused on this very individualized model of sleep intervention about the individual changing their behavior or the family or the parent changing the behavior immediately at bedtime. And we're not always looking at that broader sort of whole child, whole family, whole community kind of angle of what's going on for that person in that context that may be making sleep much more difficult for them. So the housing, as you mentioned, Dee, is one of them. There was some beautiful work done in the United States a number of years ago of a colleague of mine who was really interested in how do you support low socioeconomic families in particular area in the US with sleep. And what became really apparent is that the children couldn't sleep in their bedrooms because a lot of them were at the front of the house where there was gun violence on the streets, and really like fundamental things. So for them, it was like the critical question was, how do you create programs or interventions or supports for a family where you can't change that necessarily? We'd like to change that. We can't. That reconceptualizes what are the basic necessities to support sleep that don't have this very kind of middle class. We have a bedroom, we set up the bed, we do a light dimmer. You know, they're all great and fine, but they don't always apply. They don't work for a family living in a caravan, for example, where the whole family, the lights will go out at the same time. All of these things are really important when we think about interventions, but I think up until more recently, and I think it's coming through slowly in the literature and the research and the kind of work, you know, that individuals do in the clinical context, but those broader kind of thinking and understanding, how do we create the conditions to sleep in contexts that aren't necessarily the ones we're often thinking we're working with.
Yeah. And that partnership and actually working with families and listening and advocating, as you were saying, Jazz, you know, like those advocacy roles, I think that's super important as well, because I agree, again, otherwise we end up with that situation where people just feel like they're told to do certain things, which actually just aren't possible through no fault of their own, and then feeling judged, and so it goes on. There's no one quick fix, but I think tackling things from kind of multiple perspectives and multiple ways, but yeah, needing to be creative and hearing the reality versus assuming what the situation is pretty vital.
I think that's really true. And I think that it's, you know, you make a really, really important point, Dee, about working alongside families, which I think, you know, is something that we all really pride ourselves in doing in our research, but it's so powerful when you hear it from the families as to what the issues are, and they're often not the issues that you think they are. And you know, we did a piece of work recently where we actually spoke to a lot of the non-sleep specialists, a lot of the pediatricians in the hospital, and we asked them, you know, again, it was children with disability, but you know, how were they talking to families about sleep, and was it coming up in their conversations, and who was bringing it up, and how do they feel about that and stuff. And what was really fascinating to me, and I still to this day think it's fascinating, was that about two-thirds of the time it was the families that were bringing up sleep in these consults with these other doctors that weren't there to look at their sleep. They were there for another reason. But even more than that, there was a group of physicians who we spoke to and got survey responses from the emergency department. So these are families that have come to the emergency department for a condition, and sleep was coming up in these discussions. You know, I mean, that is telling me that families have this fundamental need for something that they're not able to achieve. They're so desperate for that. And it wasn't the reason they came to the emergency, but they brought it up, you know, in an acute situation where they're coming with a specific problem. Sleep is still at the forefront of their mind. So I think we really need to talk more to the families to work out what's going on there. You know, why is this something that we are hearing even in those situations? Probably because of what you said, Dee and Sally, that this is a fundamental need that they're actually not able to get in the way that we think they can get, because they might not have a bedroom, or they might not have, you know, a space that's safe for sleep. I think it's really fascinating when you start talking to families to really, really understand that this is far broader than making an individual change their behaviours. You know, families want to change their behaviours most of the time. It's actually way bigger than that, you know, and I think that's where there's a bigger piece of work that we all need to kind of collectively be working on.
And I think, Jazz, it's interesting that you use the word acute, that this is not an acute, well, not the issue they were coming to, but it is actually an acute issue. Often it does develop across time, but not always. Sometimes it can be quite immediate because of trauma or other things that have occurred or disruptions. Just simple things like the neighbour was fighting or the dog was going off all night. And actually sleep is an acute problem. It's not just a long-term problem, because disruption to sleep in the short term has a very immediate effect. As you said at the beginning, the next day you already feel grumpy, you eat differently, you act differently, your productivity and your ability to concentrate will be different. But it's only a couple of days that you need of sleep disruption before you have really, you know, profound effects on your health. Sally at the beginning mentioned freedom from inhumane treatment and sleep being part of that. And that is because you can kill someone from not providing sleep for them. You can have very profound effects on their brain by depriving them of sleep. And so it is an acute issue for families as well. It's not just a long-term one. And so there isn't really a place for dealing with that at the moment. But I do think there a need to consider sleep in that way too, that when, you know, when families have really acute disruption to sleep or an individual has a really acute disruption to sleep, it can have really profound effects. And those are life-threatening effects. They're not small things. They are things like, you know, not being able to drive safely on the road, those sorts of areas, as well as a whole lot of mental health and physical health.
No, I completely agree. I think that's the thing, is I think that what struck me about that is that we're waiting until these families get to a crisis point, and that's when we're intervening, you know, like, and that's when we're actually taking notice of them. You know, they're coming to hospital with something that's tipped their balance, but they've been struggling for, you know, years and years and years before that with something that is actually acute, as you say. And I completely agree with you. And I think that's the thing that I found really interesting about that work, is that we're not addressing it. Like, we actually aren't addressing that these families, that they're at a crisis, and we're the ones going, oh, okay, now we need to think about it. But actually, this has been going on for them for ages, and people are being overlooked for this really fundamental need that they have. And that goes back to what we were saying about, you know, the equity of care and the equity of social equity. It's such a big thing in when you think about sleep. And I always say that one of the challenges I think we have in the field of sleep is it's almost that same problem, is that it actually does impact on everything. So, you know, again, going to the medical framework that I'm comfortable with, you know, if you think about a medical condition, something like diabetes or something like heart disease, it's very concrete. People can think about it and go, okay, we've got a problem here, we've got to fund this, we've got to sort this out. But if you think about sleep, it's not as tangible. Like, you know, it infiltrates so many different things. It affects every condition, it affects every person. And you'd almost think that would make it more something people would want to fund, but in fact it actually makes it something that we receive way less research funding. If you look at research funding that comes nationally within Australia, sleep is getting such a small part of the pie compared to all these other conditions, and yet it's more fundamental than all those conditions. It's just harder sell, actually, which it shouldn't be, but it is.
Aotearoa as well. Yeah, it's like it's so universal that it's overlooked, weirdly.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, because trying to shift that thinking to recognize that actually, and I agree that we're not great at any kind of preventative measures in any shape or form, but again, certainly with sleep, then that's when you often see that crisis point. But I was just reflecting as you were talking then, just thinking in particular of mental health, you know, we know poor sleep typically precedes acute mental health issues for young people. But we also know that poor mental health then can flow on into poor sleep. Mm-hmm. And you can end up with that vicious cycle. And then for our children and adolescents, you know, those potential trajectories that change if sleep's not addressed. And I think that's really concerning when you think, boy, we've got an opportunity to make a real difference earlier in the life course and change those trajectories. But that does require valuing sleep at all levels and practical changes.
Well, I was thinking as you were talking, Adi, that there is also, drawing a few things, there's a real stigma around sleep in children particularly, and around families and sleep. And there is, I think, because historically we've viewed it that you either sleep well or you don't. And if you don't, then it's because you're doing something wrong. And if you did X, Y, Z, you would solve that. And the reality is there's a large genetic component, a biological component to sleep. There's an interrelationship with a range of different conditions for children and sleep. And then there's individual difference that we just get normally. And then there's this whole social world. And actually, the impact or the ability for a parent's behavior to affect sleep is, yes, there, an important part of it, but it's not as strong as we perhaps think, or at least that's where I would sit. And so I think in the context of that stigma, when we do get acute responses to sleep, particularly in children and young people, we tend to be so preoccupied with the need to stick to these social norms around sleep, around, you know, sleeping independently. We don't want to get a crocs in our back by addressing the sleep, by doing things that then they're going to get used to and then they're going to continue to do. And whilst, you know, there's arguments for or against those sorts of ways of thinking, they can be really, I think, problematic and really perversive in those places where
perhaps, you know, I'm thinking of an example of children having a really hard time with their mental health, and sleep, as you said, gets disrupted really, really quickly. And actually, the priority wasn't to, you know, you need to go to bed independently, you know, I can't be in there supporting you to get to sleep. The priority was getting the sleep right first, and then we'll work on all of the other things that we can change around the environment to try and resolve that, because we can't deal with the mental health part of these conversations unless we've got the sleep addressed, or at least part of. But I do think there's some perversive messages that come through, and they start very, very early with parents, and they continue to be problematic, and you hold on to them. It's very hard to switch off all of those social messages to say, actually, the sleep is the most important thing now. Whatever we need to do to get you sleep acutely, immediately tonight is what we're going to focus on. And then we'll deal with the other things later and work on those. I think there's some real challenges with the messaging and how we advocate around sleep to get that balance between, yes, it's really important, but it's important and there are some fundamental things we can do to support it, but they don't always have to look the same, and that it doesn't mean you're failing or you're doing something wrong if it's not quite fitting this sort of particular ideal we have that is very socially constructed and culturally constructed and does differ all over the world. Everywhere in the world we have different ways that we sleep. It's not one way we do it. There are some fundamental things, though, around feeling safe, around routines and cueing sleep, because as we said earlier, you can't force yourself to sleep. You can only create the conditions and the cueing that you need to let your body know it's time to sleep, about, you know, feeling safe and secure in your environment, things around temperature, et cetera. I'm sure Jazz and Dee have many, many more, but really it's those fundamental key characteristics. It's not the exacts of how we do it, you know, using this song at this time with this order, you know, with your bed set up in exactly this way, that is the secret to sleep.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I'll just add one more thing there to what you said, Sal, which is that, you know, you talk about the parents focused on that acute situation. I think sometimes what we also forget is that parents probably also had very little sleep. And I think one of the other things that we're not very good at doing is thinking about this holistically. You know, like we're often just focusing on a child, particularly in clinical practice. I think it's something that's really common in pediatric practices that you think about the child. We are family centered when it comes to the care we deliver within a hospital, for example. But in terms of thinking about something like sleep, I think we have to take that into the consideration. We're setting an expectation for them to do this stuff, but actually, you know, they're also sleep deprived and they're actually struggling as well. And we aren't really being fair to them by expecting them to make the change that's going to make everything better when we haven't actually acknowledged that they are in a really tough spot as well. So I think that's just another point that I think that we need to remember when we're thinking about sleep.
I think what's coming through most strongly for me is how interconnected this all is, the individual with the family, with the broader social picture. What I keep thinking about is how intergenerational this must all be. If we're talking about some of these bigger social issues, poverty, housing, the type of work that somebody's involved in, and then that affects their children's sleep. If their children aren't getting the right kind of sleep or enough sleep, that impacts their education. That impacts their future job prospects, that impacts their future children's sleep patterns. I can kind of see how it can go on and on and on and contribute to some of these social issues we're talking about. So social issues are impacting sleep. Sleep is then impacting further these social issues.
Definitely. I think you've hit the nail on the head there for sure.
It's so complex that I wonder if then that's part of the issue of it's almost too hard. But I think if we can get that message across that at multiple layers in the system, if you like, you know, there are opportunities for positive changes.
Do you have any suggestions on what you would like to see to make some of these changes?
Oh, gosh, if I had a wish list, there'd be lots, but I think you can go at so many levels, as we've said. At a health level, one of the things that I'd really like to see is taking more responsibility for that awareness and that education. The education piece is really key. I think there's a real need to go broader. And I think it's not just thinking about medical professionals. I think we need to think broader. We need to look at educating community health professionals, but also beyond health. I mean, you know, I know Sally is doing a lot of work looking at early childhood education and the education that we provide to them around sleep. That's one thing I'd really love to be able to take forward and actually see us be able to disseminate more widely this message across those who are in positions where they could actually then help to make policy change and help to make change at a government level. So I think that's one area that it would be really great to work on. And that's certainly something that we're taking forward from an ASA perspective. I think the other is probably touching a bit on what DU was saying at the beginning is really, we've got a lot of great researchers working in particular communities and with particular people who are lower socioeconomic status families, disadvantaged communities. You know, in Queensland, certainly that's people who live rural and remote as well, the First Nations population. So I think one of the things I'd like to see is that work that the researchers are doing at this point, which is really some fabulous interaction and co-design and work with these groups, is then not just research, you know, that we actually can then implement from that some changes that actually are sustainable and that continue. And I think that's where an organisation like ASA sees our role, is to help those researchers to actually take that next step. I think that's something that I feel we could do and what we will continue to work on. And I think it's keeping the conversation open with those people about what the best way to do that, because they're the ones that have actually got the insights from the actual communities as to what's going to work.
Yeah, I agree. And I think alongside that, it's advocating for real change from the governmental layer. Like, I do think, and this is my personal opinion, it's not from the institution I work for, you know, I think we have a concerning shift away from equity in a whole lot of different policies here in Aotearoa at the moment. Whereas I actually think we need to be strengthening things and advocating for equity in all policies and portfolios that are held within government. And again, we see this in housing, we see this in multiple measures of socioeconomic deprivation. You know, like, these inequities in those social aspects are so entrenched now, and we need to push back about that. So I think we need to be fighting the fight at that kind of societal level, along with then more localized community initiatives, which are amazing. And, you know, we can't sit around and wait for the structure to change. So I think recognizing that there needs to be responsive, collaborative, community led and driven with support initiatives that tackle those things that are making sleep really difficult for our young people and our adults and older people, calling out that systemic racism and discrimination against different groups is also really important. And until we have those changes that are all about equity as opposed to, you know, just letting the status quo continue, and also inequities to widen, which is certainly happening here, that's important as well, alongside supporting more locally and, you know, at the kind of family level as well. That's my thought anyway.
Building on that, there's a real place for greater public awareness around sleep, but not framed as sleep is good and we need to get it, or do X, Y, Z and you'll have good sleep, but really better understanding of why sleep matters and why certain things are really useful in supporting or not supporting sleep. And hopefully, similar to the way we've sort of made shifts in areas like mental health, trying to remove some of that stigma, because I think we underestimate how powerful that can be. I think people have a whole lot of very conflicting messages at the moment around sleep, wherever you are, and they don't always fit the context or the cultural expectation for a family or community. And I think working with those communities, working with families, working with those with lived experience, both in research but also in messaging of how we talk about sleep more broadly in society, is really, really valuable. And I think we'll go a long way across lots of different contexts where this matters, whether that's
early childhood education, where we do have sleep and we support sleep directly, but also in terms of educating people more broadly. It's a basic fundamental human right and need. In some ways it's highly complex, but in other ways it's really, really simple. Your body will sleep when it needs to sleep. It just will have trouble doing so if we don't have the conditions right to allow that to happen. And that's protective, because we want our brains and our bodies to be available to protect ourselves and stop us from being injured or hurt. It's essentially attending to what it needs to attend to. So I think it's about really thinking about how we message sleep in a way that is meaningful, relevant, and reflective of the real world people are actually living in.
I agree. And taking the judgment out and the prescription out. Really love, you know, the five principles for good sleep health that Colin Espy developed, with kind of higher level messaging around sleep, which is, you know, valuing sleep for the treasure that it is, the prioritizing of sleep by putting it first as best you can, personalizing it, which, you know, goes back to it's not a one size fits all. Trusting that your body and your brain does actually know what to do, which then leads to that kind of protecting your sleep and setting the scene as best you can in a way that works for you, and certainly in relation to children, the way that works for children and their families and their households, which might look really different from what works for the people who are living next door or, you know, wherever. So I kind of like those messages too when we're thinking about how we talk about sleep, that it's not a one-size-fits-all, that there's lots of different things that you can try or dip into within your own situation, you know, depending on what you have access to and what resonates with you and what works for you. And I think also recognising that, Sally and Jazz, you're far more expert than I am in relation to child sleep from a developmental perspective, but you know what works now isn't necessarily going to work further down the track, and that's okay too.
Absolutely. Yep. It changes across time. It's very dynamic, sleep and developmental, and it's okay to be doing things now, and you won't necessarily be doing those same things in, you know, a month's time or a year's time or 5 years' time, and that's the normal progression of sleep. In the same way, we change the way that we support our children in all sorts of other areas of their development. And that's okay. That's part of the journey.
Ethne would agree with that.
So I guess just to wrap up then, spoken about how very, very fundamental and important sleep is, and how different people have different access to sleep and the conditions that enable good sleep and flowing on from that, good health in all sorts of ways. I've really, really enjoyed this discussion. Thank you all very much. I feel like I've learned a lot. This isn't a topic that I was all that familiar with, but I feel like I've really got a really good sense now of why it's so important, and also just why we can think of sleep as a human right. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you.